Okay, so we are here to discuss, this week officially, according to the Dot schedule, is a week focusing on Torah Umara, on the interplay between learning and secular knowledge, and therefore the focus is a two-part series. This part is Kollel an ideal, and next part will be is the university an ideal. How do we live with them together? So this concept of Kollel, of massive people going to learn full-time for many years, if not limitless, is a relatively new phenomenon. This did not exist before the Second World War. And the question is this a good thing? This is a bad thing? Should it have always been this way? What's the story? So in Pirkei Avos, in this week, there is a Mishnah that says, as Rav Tzadok says, Al Tase, also Kardam Lachporbo, Atar Leskadobo, that you should not take the Torah. It should not be a shovel that you dig with, meaning that you should not use it as your profession. You should not use it as a way of getting honor. It shouldn't be a crown that you get honor with. As it says, called the Ishtamesh B'taga Chalaf, that anybody who uses Torah in any way should be killed. That's pretty strong words. So Pirkei Avos actually appears in the Gemara, even though the Daf Yom people don't do it. It's right after Avodah Zarah, and the way it's set up is the Mishnah is in the middle, and on one side, like the Gemara, you have Rashi. However, on the other side, there's no Tosfos, but rather you have the Rambam. The Rambam actually gets onto the page, and Rabbeinu Yonah is in the bottom. And the Rambam has one of his longest pieces there, where he says that, you know, for the longest time, I thought I wouldn't talk about this. I bit my tongue, I let it be as it is, you know, and now we've reached the point that I don't care what anybody else says, I don't care what the people said before me, I don't care what the people are saying currently, I have to speak out against this. And with that, the Rambam has a scathing attack on people who are making their living through the Torah. Save your seat, Rabbi.
Thank you.
So the Rambam says that it's clear as day from this Mishnah that a person should not be making their living off their Torah knowledge. So, and he's not talking about going to Kollel, right? He didn't even throw that. He says that the rabbi shouldn't get paid, the dayan shouldn't get paid, the teachers shouldn't get paid, that everybody should have a profession, and beyond the profession, those who have the ability to paskin a shiloh, they should do that. If you have an ability to teach Torah, so you should teach Torah. If you have the ability to do a din Torah, to be a dayan, you should do that. And in fact, during the time you're doing it, you're entitled to be reimbursed for the money you would have been made doing whatever you usually do, whether it's chopping wood or being an accountant or what have you not. But more than that, no, this should not be your source of income, the Rambam says. And the Rambam is very strong about it. And for example, he talks about the case of Hillel. I'm sure many people are familiar with the story of Hillel. Hillel was very poor. He used to chop wood for a living. He would get paid $2 a day. One of those dollars he would support his family with, and the other dollar he would use to pay admission to the Beis Medrash. And in fact, at one point he had a bad day, so he couldn't afford the admission, and he therefore went up to the skylight to listen in. And it snowed on him, and he was frozen, and they took him down. And they said, okay, from now on, we'll give you a discount. You don't got to come in anymore. So the Rambam says, this is Hillel, as in base Hillel. That Hillel. That's the Hillel we're talking about. So being that he is such a great rabbi, don't you think it would make sense that they should at least let him in for free, even beforehand? Don't you think people should have said, you know, what's this guy doing chopping wood? You know, here he is. He said, you think the people are a bunch of cheapskates? So let's speak Lashon Hara about the members of the community. He said, no. He said, obviously what was going on is that the people, if you'd have asked for it, would have happily supported him, but he wasn't willing to accept. And that's the reason being, because you're not allowed to accept. You can't deny the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that anybody who gets any financial advantage from their Torah learning deserves to be killed. And therefore, this idea that we should be supporting people in learning, the Rambam says, is absolutely wrong. He gives another example. He talks about Rav Chanina ben Dosa. Rav Chanina ben Dosa, who is known in the Gemara as a great miracle worker, right? The famous story about Rav Chanina ben Dosa, one time his daughter, instead of lighting oil for the Shabbos candles, lit vinegar. She was very upset. And he said, "What are you so upset about? It's no greater miracle that vinegar should burn than oil should burn. Just because naturally one happens, the fact that God makes oil burn is a miracle. So the same God can make vinegar burn, and with that he had the vinegar burn." The Gemara says about Rav Chanina ben Dosa that the entire world got supported in his merit. However, he only got a bunch of carbs per week. That's all what he ate. So again, the question is, this guy was dirt poor. How does that make sense? He was the greatest tzaddik of the generation. How come no one was supporting him? The Rambam says the answer is obvious. The answer being, because you're not allowed to. The Yiddish saying is the Torah is the best of schara. The Torah shouldn't be a schara. That people should have the ability to make a living on their own. There's something very worthwhile making a living. And then beyond that, learn all you can and become a Talmud Chacham. Right? Torah is not a profession. That's not what it is. He goes on to talk about the fact that the Gemara in Brachos says that there's a difference between Eliyahu and Elisha. And Elisha and Shmuel Hanavi, sorry. It says, HaRotze Lehenos Yene KeElisha Ben Avuya LoRotze Lehenos Lo Yene KeShmuel. Now when Shmuel used to go around, Shmuel used to be a traveling Beis Din, he would be the Navi, he would work out cases, etc. And he never took anything for it. He would never even take a meal. When he came to town, he took absolutely nothing all the time. However, as we know, for that Elisha Hanavi, there was this house he used to visit all the time, and they provided him with a table and a bed. So the Rambam says, many people say, you see, okay, if you don't want to accept, that's fine. But if you do want to accept, if you want to make a living, that's also fine. So he said, no, that's not what it means. It means that if you're already there, if someone invites you for a meal, you can go there. But to accept payment for doing this? Absolutely not. And in fact, the Rambam, as he goes on, he has many, many examples where he talks about the Gemara seemingly indicating that what the Mishnah says is obvious. He points to two very strong cases. One is a case of Rav Tarfon. Rav Tarfon was a great Tana. He appears in the Mishnah regularly. He's also very wealthy. And there's a story the Gemara tells that one day Rav Tarfon was sitting by walking down the road. And it used to be, this time of year, right after they would harvest all the fruit, they would put the fruit on the roofs to dry out. Right? In order to be able to use the fruit throughout the winter, you dry it out in the summer, and that preserves it. It's a method of preserving it to last through the winter months where there will not be produce. And the rule is that if somebody has their fruit on the roof and the dried raisins, whatever it is, blows off, it becomes hefker. It becomes ownerless, and whoever wants can take it. So he's walking down the road one day, and in fact, this is what happened. And he starts eating. Now here's the background to the story. The background of the story is this farmer's been having a problem all year. That there's a guy who's been stealing the produce. Every day someone's stealing, and he can't take it anywhere. So he walks and he sees this guy eating the produce. He said, "I finally got him." So he runs behind him, he puts him in a sack, throws him over his shoulder, and now he's gonna go and take him and throw him in the river. So if Tarfon's in a sack, in case of mistake, I think he's going to be thrown in the river. So he yells out, "Oh, poor Tarfon, he's about to be killed." The guy realizes, uh-oh, I definitely got the wrong guy. Drops the sack and runs away. The Gemara goes on to say that Rav Tarfon never got over this. Because he said, "Oh my goodness, I use my status as Rav Tarfon for my own personal benefit. I could have bribed the guy. I could have not told him who it was. I offered him $1 million. Just let me go." He said, the fact that I used my status, that's a terrible thing. He says, what could be more obvious than that? Here's the Gemara says specifically that rather than use your status, you have to give up money. So that's case number one, which the Rambam thinks makes it definitely clear that one cannot accept money for learning Torah. Case number two is an interesting one. There was once a famine, and Rabbeinu HaKadosh was a wealthy man, and he announced that I'm opening up my storehouses, and anybody who's a Talmud Chacham is welcome to come and eat for free. A guy shows up, and they say to him, "Nu, can you learn Gemara?" He says, "Not so much." How about a little Chumash? Also not so much. So he said, "Sorry, you know, what can we do for you?" So he said, "Tell me, if a stray dog was starving, would you feed it? You know, if a stray raven came here, would you feed it? Feed me like it's feed, no worse than a stray animal." Okay, fine. So after the bear crush fell dead, wait a second, this guy got me. So I said to him, "You know what? Don't be so sure. It could be that guy was Yonasan ben Amram. Yonasan ben Amram is a student of yours, and he doesn't want to get any credit for being a Talmud Chacham. So and I looked into it, and son of a gun, they were right." So the Rambam says, "Come on, there you have it." The guy refused to say who he was in order to get any benefit. So the Rambam says, even though I know this is against everything that everybody else holds, and I know it's against what all the previous generations held, I think that the Mishnah is the Mishnah, and I have to say what I have to say, and that's what it is. In fact, the Rambam in his Mishnah Torah goes further and says a person cannot get any hanah, any benefit from his Torah knowledge, and if he does, it's a chil Hashem, and ultimately it will lead to robbery. The idea being that if a person doesn't have a job, he's going to have to get his money some way, and when all the legal options run out, that's what you're left with. So this is the very strong opinion of the Rambam. The Rambam does not think that people should get paid to learn in Kolo. But then again, he also doesn't think people should get paid to teach in yeshivas. He doesn't think people should get paid for being rabbis of congregations or anything else for that matter. Now, the Rambam himself admits that his opinion is a original opinion. And in fact, this is not the traditional opinion. However, he says, you know, look, I got the Mishnayos on my side. It probably doesn't come as a shock that there's a very strong reaction to this opinion of the Rambam. Most notably, the Tashbetz, followed by the Kesef Mishnah, both write pieces on it. And they both take the Rambam on head on. And they go case by case to explain why his proofs aren't proofs. And they bring proofs the other way. For example, when they refer to the Kohen Gadol, it says, "A Kohen HaGadol Me'achav." So the Gemara says, "God Leu Mishal Achav." There is a mitzvah that the Kohen Gadol should be financially secure. And he should be independent. So why should the Kohen Gadol be any different than else? Why should he be supported and nobody else? He also goes on to say that, let's look at the cases that we have considered so far. He says, Hillel freezes on the rooftop because no one's taking care of him. At what point of Hillel's career was that? So that's talking about when Hillel was a yeshiva bacher. And Hillel was a yeshiva bacher when he was starting out. So, okay, like everybody else, you chop wood, you make a living, you come to the Beis Medrash, you work on it. So once Hillel became the Rosh Yeshiva, you think he was still hanging out there? Not true. This is a story from early in Hillel's career. But of course, when Hillel became the Magid Shir, what were they collecting the money for? Who was making the money on this? They were charging admission and they needed additional parking spaces? What was it? So when you go hiking here, whenever they charge you for something, they explain that, don't worry, all the money's going to parking spaces and porta potties. They always make it, don't worry, not the way, no, it's where it's all going, every penny. So, he says, so that to say that this is a proof is very hard to accept. Similar to the idea of Rav Chanina ben Dosa. So Rav Chanina ben Dosa had a personal stringency, that he would not accept anything from anyone. Okay, if you want to do it, that's fine. But that doesn't make it the rule. Because one person has a personal stringency, that means everyone has to follow it. So therefore, the Hashbeis and the Kesef Mishnah both are very opposed to the opinion of the Rambam, very strongly so. And with that, they say, that's just not the way it is. Now, what about the two cases we focused on? Right? The two major cases that he brings down, the case of Yonasan ben Amram, who refused to say who he was at a time to get food. Rather, he had to try to knage his way into his meal. And also the case of Rabbi Tarfon. So the Tashbeit says, well, let's look at that case a little closer. Okay? Rabbi Meir says, if you're not a Talmud Chacham, I'm not feeding you. Okay. Yonasan ben Amram says, I don't want to admit it. So we're focusing on Yonasan ben Amram. Let's focus on Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Why did he say, I'm only going to give food to Talmidei Chachamim? And the only way I'm going to give it to you is if you have Torah learning. To whatever extent you can tell me that Yonasan ben Amram's chumer is a proof that you can't get paid, the fact that they were only giving it to the people who were learners is a bigger proof the other way. If there was a rule that you can't get any benefit from Torah knowledge whatsoever, then how could they have ever made this rule? The fact that they made the rule would seem to indicate that a person is entitled to some sort of compensation. So therefore the Tashbeit says, I see the opposite proof here. Similarly, when he goes to the case of Rav Tarfon, he said, what bothered Rav Tarfon? What bothered Rav Tarfon is he had another way out. The fact that he was wealthy, he could have gotten out of it another way. So he said that there's a difference in getting advantage from it. It's one thing if I'm learning Torah, and I'm teaching Torah, I'm rabbinating, whatever I'm doing. I am doing something, I'm providing the service, and therefore I am getting taken care of. Let's say Facebook is going public, and I say, Zuckerberg, you're Jewish, I'm a rabbi. I should get in first. That's not right. You can't use it to randomly pull rank. It's like the other of Tarfon says, basically, let me off, even though you think I stole because I'm a rabbi. That's what Yechol Hashem. That's in that case it's wrong. But if you ask someone to do a job for you, so why is it wrong that they should get paid for it? So this is the major machlokes between the Rambam on the one hand and what ends up being the Kesef Mishnah on the other hand. Now, who wrote the Kesef Mishnah? Yosef Karo. And he wrote a few other books, for example. Shulchan Aruch, most notable among them. So what's interesting is in the Shulchan Aruch, this halacha is quoted, and Yosef Karo doesn't take sides one way or the other. And with that, the Ramah spells out that the different possibilities. Some people say it's mutter, some people say it's aser, and some people say it's up to you. So going through the Shulchan Aruch, it's really unclear as to what is the decision here. Now, as I mentioned, obviously, throughout history, the rabbi of the town has always been paid. Now, the Tashbeis writes that there's, and in fact, I think the Kesef Mishnah writes, there's a good reason for this. Because not everybody's the Rambam. Not everybody who's a Talmud Chacham also happens to have a medical degree. Right? Which the Rambam happened to have. So it's great that you, Rabbi Dr. Rambam, can sit back and say, I won't get paid for what I do. That's lovely. We're happy for you. We're glad you're independently wealthy. We're glad you have a nice practice. we're glad that Sultan Care hasn't done you in, you know, that you've got you've got your connections and you're able to take care of all the major players. That's lovely. And if you want to say, and because of this, I am not going to accept any payment for my services rendered, but to turn around and say, and therefore every other rabbi is going to have to starve to death. Being a rabbi is a full-time job. Being a teacher is a full-time job. Dayan's a full-time job. All these positions are full-time jobs. So you're going to. So what are you going to end up doing now? Okay, if I want to be a rabbi, now I can't get paid. So either I'm going to be, my family's going to be starving, and I'm going to be standing on the street corner collecting, or more likely, I'm going to say, well, the rabbinate, I don't think it's for me.
Maybe a lot less people involved.
Right. That, you know, you get what you pay for, and if you're not paying, you're not getting. That's what Tashmit says, that at the end of the day, it's very difficult to maintain the position of you have to do it for free. Because ultimately, basic economics, this isn't going to work out. That being said, when you look at the Shulchan Aruch, there are three opinions that are basically thrown out. One is the rabbi is not allowed to get paid. The next one is if you don't need the money, you're not allowed to get paid. And the third one is even if you don't need the money, you can take it. Now, what would the logic behind that be? The logic is really kind of strong. If we're turning around and saying, listen, only the people who need the money are going to get paid, that says to me, I shouldn't be taking it. There's something wrong with taking it. And therefore, you know, I don't want to be a bidyeved rabbi. I want to be the real deal. So if I'm going to be the real deal, I'm not going to take it. Now, I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to have any money. We're back in the original place. So therefore, it's a chumr mevili de kula. So because I don't take the money, I'm not going to take the money. If I don't take the money, I'm not going to I'm not going to be able to get by. I'm not going to be able to buy. I'm going to drop out, and that's going to be the end of it. So therefore, in order to make sure that anybody who is qualified and should be doing this is doing this, it is necessary for me to make sure that everyone's taking the money, that no one should think that there's anything wrong with it. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, a very interesting tshuva, where he talks about the idea of whether it's better to get a job as well or just to learn full-time. That's what he talks about. Now, what I've spoken up until now doesn't really touch on kolel yet. Right? Because every case I've spoken about is talking about a case where somebody is actually providing a service for their payment. Right? The rabbis, the teachers, etc. Right? These are services which are in normal society paid. Teachers get paid in public schools, teachers get paid in universities, right? Teachers should probably get paid in yeshivas as well. Right? No one would ever look at the concept of a teacher getting paid for what they do and say, oh, there's something wrong with this. Maybe during the summer months, but during most of the year, people are relatively cool with it. So, but the question then becomes one step beyond, and that is the issue of people who are in the kollel system. The people who are in the kollel system are not necessarily providing services, and in some cases specifically are not. Meaning that if the purpose of the kollel is to make sure someone maximizes their potential in Torah knowledge, anything that they are doing other than focusing full-time on their Torah knowledge is going to take away from it. Right? If the person has to even give classes, one would argue, but even less than that, you know, do whatever work it is on the side, have them teach. This will not allow them to maximize their abilities, and therefore, you know, there are definitely people who are of the opinion that not only do they not have to, but perhaps they should not do anything but learn full time. And the value to the community of the person who is learning full time is their knowledge. That itself is the value. But Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva on it, where a guy says, you know, I'd like to be machmer like the Rambam. I like to follow the opinion of the Rambam. And therefore, I'd like to, you know, I'll become an accountant. I'll do a little real estate. And then, you know, I'll make enough money to get by. And I feel better doing that than getting paid to learn. And Moshe Feinstein was very dismissive of it. Moshe Feinstein said, that's your Yetzer Hara speaking. Because we know how things work. You're going to go out to the world, you know, time is limited. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you have potential, that's not what you should be doing. So the bottom line is that among the modern poskim, the stance of Avadi Yosef has it like this is very much in support of the Kollel system. Not 100%, but largely. Shachter has had some words that are less than positive about it over the years, even though he himself is a Rosh Kollel. But not in a long-term Kollel. No, his Kollel only lasts as long as Smicha, by and large. So the question is, what happened here? What happened to the machokas between the Rishonim, which focused solely on the idea of can we pay the rabbi or not, to this idea of not only do we pay the rabbi, etc., but we pay everybody who wants to learn, period. Where did the shift come? And the answer, if you read through the tshuvas, is significant. And I think it's not that foreign from secular thinking either. There is a concept of kollel in the secular world, and that's called graduate school. What? My wife graduated college. From there, she became a chemistry kollelnik. For 5 years, she studied kollel. She studied chemistry. She took classes 1 year. From there on in, she just sat back thinking great thoughts, and she was paid. She received a salary for this, and was paid by the government, the National Institute of Health, and governments pay for it, and universities pay for it, etc. This is something that is normal. If you're going to a graduate school where you hope to make money one day, like medical school or law school or the like, so they're not, or business school, they're not going to pay you for that. But if you're going to go to a graduate school where the upside in salary is not as great, not a professional school, so it is standard that you, of course, are not charged tuition for it, and not only that, but there is usually a fellowship, some sort of stipend that comes along with it. So why is that? Why does secular society have kollel?
To encourage scholarly
pursuits, right? We think that there is value in knowledge. We think, take anything, okay, chemistry, you might say, okay, maybe she'll discover something one day, right? One day she's going to figure a way to cure AIDS, world hunger, what have you. She'll make me rich and keep me supported in the manner that I've grown accustomed to. No, good. Halavai. But even history, art, what have you not, English literature, the idea is that we see that there is value in knowledge, for sure. And there is value in, as a bare minimum, providing teachers for the next generation, that this should not die out. So therefore the universities and the government steps in and they will pay for the person just to sit and learn. This concept should not be any less important when it comes to Torah. As much as we need scholars in the humanities and in the sciences, etc., we also need Torah scholars. I think we can all agree on that. Yes?
So the cynic in the room would say that to get there, it's a very select process.
Correct.
I
don't know if you have to be the cynic to even say that.
I'm just saying. Let
me spell it out. You're saying that if I showed up at Columbia and I said to them, I'd like to sit and study chemistry for the next few years, how about you pay me for it? They wouldn't necessarily naturally jump at the opportunity to have me sign up for their program. Right? There is a very significant process with admissions requirements, whether it's the GRE or GPA, etc., and not everybody can get into it. That's absolutely true. And going a step beyond, you know, it gets, the longer you stay, the more selective it is, right? There are people who go for their PhDs, and they get support for that, and then there are people that become postdocs and get supported through that, and then there are people who open up their own labs and are getting grants forever. Right? And they're the ones the universities want. Right? My wife recently was, this past year, got herself a nice NIH grant because they determined that she was at a level where, you know, even though she already has her doctorate, her research is important still, that we should support it. So that is absolutely a correct point. The point being that the idea that we want to support people in learning does not mean open admissions. Now, to a certain point, yes, I think we want everybody to have an elementary school education. Everybody in the Jewish people, whoever's interested, should be entitled to learn the Aleph-Bays. Right? They should be entitled to learn how to read the Siddur. They shouldn't be entitled to learn to read the Chumash and Rashi. Right? I think we can all agree on that. That when it comes to the lower grades and teaching, you know, basic Judaism, it would be wonderful if all Jewish children in our community, elsewhere, would have the basic knowledge. And if what was keeping them back from getting that education was finances, I think that the Jewish community would agree that it should be subsidized, whether through the UJA, however it would work. I would think that every Jewish child should have the opportunity to have a Jewish education. This has not always been the case, you should know. The Gemara in Bava Basra tells us the story that for years and years it was children who had fathers who could teach them learned, and the other ones didn't. And eventually they set up an educational system. And the educational system, which is probably the model we should go back to, was paid for by the community. There was no tuition. It was public schools. Every kid, up until a certain age, was entitled to free Jewish education. And everybody had to pay for it, whether your kid was in the yeshivas or not. If you look at the crisis of Jewish education, the problem is we're taxing the people who could afford at least. Right? The parents who are raising these kids, they're the ones who have to bear the entire brunt of the cost of the education. As opposed to if you would say that the entire community, even the people that thank God are retired, etc., should also be paying for the education, then you'd have a situation where everyone would probably be paying the same in the end anyhow. Because I'm saving money now on my kids' education, but God willing, I live a long, healthy life, I'll be paying, you know, for much longer. But at a time where I can afford it. So there was this concept in the Gemara, which is a concept we come from, that every kid is entitled to a Jewish education. But till when? So the Gemara talks about it until the age of 13, maybe. Maybe a little longer. At least they should be able to learn Chumash. What about Mishnah? What about Gemara? So that's a discussion. You know, whether the free education goes that far. But there definitely has to be, we all agree, a certain base level of education that every Jewish child is entitled to. Whether that's a certain amount, attaining a certain proficiency, or it's a certain amount of years, and in those years you can, yes, make the proficiency, no, make the proficiency, or go beyond the proficiency. There you have it. The question is, what happens afterwards? So if somebody wants to pay for greater yeshiva education, that's great. I think if somebody, you know, if I am independently wealthy and I'd like to sit and learn, I don't think anyone has a problem with that. If I'm independently wealthy and I want to support my kids to learn for years, I want to pay their education for years to come, I don't think anyone's got a problem with that. What if I want to support my son-in-law? Also, my money. You know, I could blow it on a new car, I could blow it on him. Do what you want with it. The question becomes when you start taxing the society and saying that, you know, I want an education and therefore you have to pay for it. So at that point, you know, there comes an issue. The Rambam has a very interesting statement elsewhere. At the end of the halachas of Shmita V'Yovel, no, Trumas and Maisvis, I believe, sorry, take that back, there is a discussion, it's one or the other, where the Rambam says, what did Shevet Levi do? Shevet Levi made approximately up 1/3% of the Jewish people? Right? 1/12? Around shuls, they tend to, the Kohanim and Levim tend to be more. Yeah. But, you know, but the entire Shevet Levi, including the Kohanim, what did they do? They taught. And how were they supported? Shulam Semaisos. That is correct. Right? Basically, they learned full-time, and they were supported by the public. So the Rambam has a concept, has an idea that not just Levium, but anybody who wants to announce that they are a Levi, not that you can get a better Aliyah out of it, has the right to say, you know, I'd like to go for it. So how does that work? The same Rambam who was saying that we're not even going to pay the rabbi, suddenly says, all right, anyone who comes to Kol, you're going to get supported. So there's a concept in the Gemara, right? It's based on the Levium as well. At one point it says the Levium start to work at the age of 25. Another point it says they start to work at the age of 30. So Chazal comment, they got 5 years to learn what they're, at 25 they go to school, at the age of 30 they got to be ready to work. But to be a Levi, there's things you got to learn. To be a Kohen, you got to learn, you know, how to do the different avodas, etc. The Gemara says, based on this, if someone spends 5 years learning and is not roa simin bracha, and that person has not been successful, it's time to give it up. It's time to pack it in. So, it would seem that that's the rule, that a person gets those 5 years. Right? And those 5 years probably started the bar mitzvah. And by the age of 18, we see how you're doing. Are you a person who's cut out for this? Not to be cut out for this, as Val said, the one is you need a certain amount of mental ability. A person just doesn't have it. If a person doesn't have a Gemara cup, you know, this isn't the profession for you. If the person, you know, has a good mind, but he just doesn't have the tochus, he can't sit that long, that's also not for you. So basically, the idea being that everyone gets a trial for a certain amount of time, and that certain amount of time probably coincides with the high school years in our society, to see who really has the ability. And if a person shows that they have the ability, then they move on. And that's probably the same approach as we do in secular society, right? You have open admissions in colleges. There's no open admissions when it comes to graduate school. When it comes to graduate, we got to see what you're worth. You've got to prove yourself. And there are people that will prove themselves that, you know what? This guy's going to be a good local rabbi. This guy's going to be a good teacher, high school, elementary school, base medrash. And then beyond that, there are going to be some people who are going to say, you know what? This guy's the real deal. This guy could be the next Moshe Feinstein. He could be the next Chazon Ish. This is the guy who could be the Golem. And I don't want that guy to, you know, to be doing funerals. And I don't want that guy to be marking midterms. I want that guy to be sitting and learning and really come back to him 20 and 30 years from now. And at that point, I've got leaders.
But in the, just to go back for a second to Arya's point, I don't know about necessarily the wide world as much, but in, for example, Lakewood world, mm-hmm. or in the Mir in Israel, it's a pretty easy admission to get into. There's no real chena to get in or to sit in Kollel world there. So,
and there's also no payment.
No, but
which is also important.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying.
So you open up a base measure and say whoever wants to sit here can basically sit here, but we're not going to pay you for it. That's the idea. You know, you want to support yourself. I threw some. Edos has a base medrash. There's no test to get in.
No, great. Right? But I'm just saying, if you, right? Put
you either come at the right time or you know the code. Those are the two possibilities.
No, I'm saying eventually it turns into a style that they need some type of support. So you're opening, while it's not officially called support, you're opening a system where eventually they're going to need support.
So that's
whether it's this generation, the next generation.
No, so that's the question. Again, I think the issue isn't the people. If you can somehow or another afford to be doing this, right? If I wanted to study chemistry, this is my dream. And I say, basically, you know, I would like to attend some graduate classes, right? I'd like to audit the classes.
You can do that online now.
What? Right. I go to Harvard online now. I'm never going to get a degree out of it. But if you want to learn, Right? Right? This has been a major turnover the last few years. Basically, if you, what you're really interested in now is in knowledge and not a piece of paper, the world is open. Right? The same idea here. You want to use our svarim? You know? Assuming you make, can basically pass as a normal person who's not going to burn the place down, you're in. So I don't have such an issue with that. The issue is, if you're going to come to me and say, I've got a kolo, I have 100 guys learning there. Oh, so what?
So,
that's the question.
Individuals, the mere cup or lake water, this or that, they send you the flyer, they send you the mishalachim, whatever it is.
So
end
that's
of the day, you're paying for it.
So that's the question. So I don't think, again, the point I'm making is, in my opinion, and I think this fits in well, is that there is a need for the kollel system. It's a good thing, but open admissions is a bad idea.
Right. Because out of the 500 guys, let's just example, that sign up each year, there's probably 10 of guys who can be the next Ramosha person, so if that.
So you know, but you know, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
Me and Nathan Rabinovich went to Lakewood earlier this month. It was my first time I was ever there. They were in for a wedding. We went together. And we got there a little early. So I said, you know, Nathan, Rachel, Avi was there. I've never been to the base Medrash. We got some time. Let's put it in the GPS. And how far could it be? Let's go. It was a Sunday morning in June. I was wearing a hat and a black suit. Nathan was wearing a pink shirt to the wedding. So I said, we're going to walk in together. And if anyone stops us, I'm being Makar with you, okay? And if they start asking questions, I start referring to you as Mr. Barron. Okay, that's how we're going to get by here. So I had never been there before in my life. So I walked in the front door, walked into the base medrash. The place was packed. 10:30 on a Sunday morning in June, you could not get a seat. And I obviously didn't go person to person, as there were many of them there. But what seemed to be going on, based on my so
they
much
could be learning, just doesn't mean they're necessarily learning.
Right. So you know, I felt good about that.
Right. I'm not disagreeing that learning is a bad
thing. Right. I am sure there are places where you walk in, and people haven't quite made it yet at 10:30, and it's a Sunday and it's June. So that's the question: is that there are yeshivas out there that are real serious? I mean, one rule of thumb before I send the check is: so do you give your guys tests? I feel better if there are tests. There are many yeshivas, particularly in Israel, that you don't get paid a monthly stipend. You get paid if you pass the test. There's a certain amount of tests. You pass five of these tests in a month, you get paid per test. You pass two of them, you don't pass any. Go home and explain that to your wife. Right? So there are concepts like Mifal Hashas, which does this. Which is out there to make sure these people are serious, that they're not drafting the dodge, they're not dodging the draft. Sorry about that. They're not, they're not just, you know, living off the fat of the land. They're not just sitting there, you know, saying, "Oh, let me have a great shidduch because I'm learning in Kollel." There are people out there, and how many of them are going to be with Moshe Feinstein? If we're lucky, one. If we're lucky, one. But you know what? If the other guys, you know, will write a useful sefer, will end up teaching, will end up going out, there's value to that.
Is there a discussion about the Yisachar Zvulun model?
So it's very interesting, Yisachar Zvulun model. One time a guy came over to me.
So just to clarify, right? So it's the two Shvatim.
Right.
Yisachar Zvulun made an arrangement where one would learn, one would work. And the one who would learn and the other would get smart, get the merits for their learning. The other would support the other. So it's a partnership.
So a person who I know is a fine Talmud Chacham and extremely serious in their learning. One time was short on cash, marrying off kids, etc., and repeatedly was coming around. So I said, I'll make you a deal. $5,000 a year, and I want 10% of your schar. Here, I'll sign a contract. I'll put it down. What do you say? So the guy, here's because the guy says, I don't want to take a handout. Don't take a handout. I want to buy something. I want to buy your schlar. I'll sign on it. Here's a check, $5,000. So I think that there are svarim written about the Yisachar's rule and arrangement. Some people say it's got to be 50-50. I got to give 50% of whatever I make. For that, I get 50% of the schlar. And there's no other way of doing it. So, according to that. Now, do I get schlar for their learning if I support it, even without an official contract? I would imagine so. I imagine that being an enabler, in this case, is a good thing. So, I don't know how much the technicalities of Yisachar's Vilna work out. But I always say as follows. This is my view on tzedakah in general. It's interesting. So, tzedakah basically goes to two major categories: poor people and Torah. Those are the two major categories. There are things that don't fit into the two, right? You know, hospitals, give to make the Shari Tzedek in Yerushalayim, doesn't necessarily even pay for the Erev, the mikvah. Right? These are things that somehow fall beyond the two. But in general, those are the two standard categories. And the Chofetz Chaim tells us the rule of thumb is that our tzedakah dollars should be split basically evenly between the two of them. Half should go to poor people, soup kitchens, what have you. That's both in Israel, here, more locally than abroad. And the other half should go to tzedakahs, which involve Torah learning. Again, more locally, whether it's the elementary school here, the yeshiva here, the kollel here, etc. And then beyond, a certain amount to Lakewood, without saying why you, of course, and and places in Israel. So my approach always has been as follows, that I give a certain percentage of my net income every year to tzedakah. I get a paycheck, that comes off. That's how much money I'm going to give to charity this year, one way or another. You can, 100 people ask from people, one person asks me, that's the amount that's going out. So I, now this money is no longer mine, it is tzedakah's money. And now I am in charge. I am the agent in charge of distributing these monies. I am the trustee of these funds. And at this point, I've got to make a decision of who is most worthwhile. Just like if I had a certain amount of my money to invest before I would send out a check to a mutual fund or to a stock or to a real estate investment or the like, I would look into it and I'd say, okay, this is something I feel really good with. I'm going to give them a nice chunk of money. This is a long shot, so I'm going to give a little check. So too, tzedakah has to be treated the same way. And before you send a check, whether it's to Lakewood, Mir, YU, wherever else, a person should look into what's being done with their money. And a person should be as careful with their tzedakah investments, their charitable investments, as they are with their financial investments in general. So therefore, the answer is that when it comes to say, I'm collecting for a kollel, that's pretty broad. There are kollels where the people are learning on a very serious level and they're getting a very meager stipend and they're really doing it because this is what they want to do and they're showing potential. And there are other types as well. And therefore we have, as the people that are supporting it, we have an obligation to look into it. So in sum, I think we definitely reject the opinion of the Rambam. It's very interesting. There is a series of tshuvas that discuss this type of thing. For example, there is a tshuva who talks about it used to be in New York that New York Telephone gave a discount for clergy. I can tell you they don't anymore. In fact, they don't even exist anymore, New York Telephone. That's probably part of the reason. What? The only person that gives us a break is the government, the domiciliary allowance. So the question is, are you allowed to accept that? Or are you accepting something for being a Talmud Chacham? The answer is no. If you're a priest, they'd give it to you also. It's not because you're a Talmud Chacham. Don't worry about it. That's fine. But I think at this point, there's definitely an absolute agreement that people that are doing Jewish communal work do get paid. The Rambam is a minority opinion that has been thoroughly rejected. When it comes to the idea of being paid to learn Torah, so there is an idea that people should be paid. And in my opinion, the idea is similar. I'm close to parallel to the idea of graduate schools. And now one of them burned up. What a letdown. Oh, man. So that being that we definitely support some education for everyone, right? And that's something that in fact I think we'd all want more of, right? The more kids that we could get to have a yeshiva education, that would be great. I can't see anyone arguing the fact that if the kid's Jewish, they should know what it means and they should know the basics. They should be able to read the Siddur. They should be able to know what it is they're supposed to do. They should be able to open a Chumash. They should know the stories. There's definitely a certain minimum that everyone's got to know. And then there comes a point, wherever that line is, beyond the minimum, where there are some people that should still be going, and to the point that we should be supporting them. Because, I mean, on the most basic case, it is a graduate school as well. Right? We do need rabbis. Right? We do need rabbis for congregations, we need rabbis to teach, we need rabbis to do kashrus, you know, get and based in. There are many things that we need rabbis to do. So that we also need. But beyond graduates, the graduate school angle of it, there is a further angle still, and that is the angle of we need the scholars. However, I agree with you. That has to be limited to the people who show the potential. In YU, the approach has always been that, you know, Kolel goes until Smicha. After that, if you want to get a further few years, it's a very limited amount. There's the few, the proud, that get taken care of afterwards. And that's that. You know, and at that
point, they have to make their own living, you mean?
What?
Do they have to make their own living?
No, the people that are accepted to what's called the Kolel Elyon, they are paid for 3 or 4 years to keep on learning, even beyond Smicha.
I meant the other ones.
The other ones, at that point, they've got to get a job.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought you meant.
Right, and that job is, you know, either a pulpit, or it's a teaching position, or it's Jewish administration. You know, there's many jobs out there. And you know, that's the way it is, you know. And you've also have, over the years, you've developed this halfway position. You go out to a community, where you're a member of a community kollel, which doesn't mean that you learn full-time, it means that you learn half-time, and you do outreach to the community, or you learn with the community at nights, etc. So sort of the halfway house before you actually have to go get a job. But I think that's the idea. I think the idea is that if I had to answer the question that we started, is the kollel an ideal? The answer is yes for some people, but probably not for everybody. Any questions? Yes.
So if you have a pool of money that's limited,
what has mincha, Rabbi?
8:50.
What? 8:50? Great. like was already.
Now. What,
Mark? Well, we're going to do mincha first tonight.
So if you got,
you're 7:55, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, the phenomenon has been that some of those monies are directed to these kollelim, that some are valid and some are not valid, according to the theory. So whose responsibility is it to educate the masses or give a psak that it's rather should go to the kids?
I think that
communal.
I think, again, I assume that the gatekeeper of most charities community is the rabbi, and I think it's the duty of the rabbi to say, you know, this is something that we should really support, or just remain silent on the other ones, and the silence will speak volumes as to how. I remember people used to come to Rabbi Shach this year to collect. Some people got a quarter, some people got a dollar, and some people got a check. And everybody in the room knew what that meant. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's what we got to do. I think again, if you have enough money, you hire a guy to do it for you. But if you don't have enough money, if you're not running a major charitable foundation, you know, you got to do the best as you can, you know, to invest wisely. Okay. I think we should go daven. Thank you.